Welcome to AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we aim to take you to the heart of ag policy. I'm Hannah Pagel. Our guest this week is Deputy Ag Secretary Jule Brunaugh, who joins us to discuss USDA's workforce, her recent trade mission to the UK, and the progress of USDA's equity programs. But first, here's this week's headlines. The Supreme Court rejected a second petition dealing with the labeling of Roundup herbicide. Justices did not grant a hearing to Monsanto's petition, seeking review of an earlier decision that found the nation's pesticide law does not preempt state law claims. The order denying the petition was issued less than 1 week after the court denied a similar petition in another Roundup case. Monsanto, which is now owned by Bayer, says it has settled about 80% of the Roundup cancer claims. The Department of Agriculture says it has distributed more than $4 billion in emergency relief program payments. That makes up two-thirds of the $6 billion the department plans to send in the first wave of the program. Pre-filled ERP applications were mailed to producers hit by natural disasters in 2020 and 2021. USDA also plans to release a second batch of funding for producers who lack the crop insurance data to receive a pre-filled application. USDA says commodity and specialty crop producers have until July 22nd to complete applications. In other USDA news, department officials wrapped up a trade mission in the United Kingdom this week. Improving trade relations with the UK has been a high priority for American farm groups since it officially left the European Union 2 years ago. But there has been no formal agreement to address things like tariffs and U.S. food safety practices. USDA Deputy Secretary Jule Brunaugh headed up the delegation of more than 30 American agribusiness professionals in a trip that wrapped up earlier this week. When we spoke to her, we asked her, what did USDA learn about the potential for U.S. ag exports to the U.K.?
I would definitely say the U.S.-UK trade mission was what I would consider very successful. We went on the trade mission with a primary goal of really trying to ensure that we could get high quality food and agricultural products from the US to the UK. Going into that conversation, we realized that there were some potential points of discussion around tariffs, trying to reduce tariffs, non-tariff barriers, and just thinking about some of the old practices of the European Union that still influence the UK. We knew going in that we were going to have to encourage the use of science-based and data-driven decision-making in terms of their food and ag policy. So we raised those issues. And another goal was to encourage the UK to sign on to the Sustainable Productivity Growth Coalition, the SPG Coalition, and had good outcomes. 21 US companies participated. There were more than 235 business meetings with over 40 UK buyers. And so we're still going to determine what the projected sales results are within the next couple of weeks from those interactions. But we did get Secretary of State Eustace to sign on to the SPG Coalition. He is the Secretary for Environment, Food, and Rural Affairs. And he announced that he signed on at Parliament. So that was incredibly exciting to have him a member of that really important conversation. And in terms of the UK's work in genetic technology and precision breeding, they have a bill that they're considering signing, which really focuses on biotech. And we know that the work there with gene editing and gene modification is extremely important and could further improve our interactions. They are really optimistic about moving forward with that bill. And lastly, we had some very good conversation about how we could work together to improve the perception of U.S. agriculture in the U.K., inviting them to come and witness our efforts to safely and securely deal with animal welfare, raise our products, and how and why we have the safest food and ag products in the world.
Mm-hmm. So pivoting the conversation a little bit, you know, there's been a lot of changes in the U.S. workforce post, you know, the COVID-19 pandemic. How has that dynamic impacted USDA staffing levels?
Well, we went to a maximum telework posture during the pandemic, and I think that was a big change for everyone, having to very quickly deliver the same level of service using telework as a platform as opposed to physically being in the office. And I think we joined our other federal agencies and partners in doing that. And we moved to that process. And one thing that we are very proud of, especially in our field-based offices, where we have our FSA, our NRCS, rural development offices all across the United States, in that challenge, we continue to see high levels of productivity in delivering programs. Now, was that easy? It absolutely was not easy, but we're very proud that our staff continue to work hard to deliver those services. Now, you know, transitioning back to the physical workplace, that's another big deal. We started that process for our senior leadership in February, at the end of February. The remaining employees began to transition at the end of March. They were given at least 45 days notice before returning to the workplace. We were able to get most back on, but we knew we had to have some negotiations with more than our 80 bargaining units. So all negotiations there were completed in June. And we will ensure that we'll have a re-entry completed for all of our employees by mid-August. So we are most of the way there. We're emphasizing safety because we know that our workforce is very important. It's a top priority. We're also continuing the flexibility and innovation in our work schedules, understanding that we have to deliver on our mission. So, you know, as more employees return back to the physical workplace, we'll monitor the transition rates, make sure everyone is safe, but we're going to continue to keep people safe while focusing on high productivity and offering up to 8 days per pay period for telework options for those who qualify.
Mm-hmm. And would you say Congress has given you enough money to kind of help address with staffing as these employees come back to the office?
We're very grateful for all of the money that Congress has provided. And what we're doing in cases of where we see that we have some needs, we are identifying what those needs are and making sure that in future budgets that we can convey that information. I mean, we are very appreciative of all the funding through the various funding streams that we have been provided to address that. But if, certainly everyone's kind of grappling with IT needs, with office space utilization, and we are looking at how we can be more efficient in what we are doing so that we don't have to have additional requests that are unnecessary. So as we look to future funding, we're looking at enterprise approaches to IT systems that can help everyone. We're looking at the effective use of office space and how we can combine workspace. And so certainly we're doing our due diligence to try to be efficient, but we are also prioritizing what additional needs are as we try to transition people to a new work environment.
We'll be right back with more from Deputy Secretary Bernard right after this.
Regenerative poultry production is a process by which nature can actually recapture and restore the energy that is being taken out of our space.
Farm Credit helped Rahi build his dream of regenerative poultry farming and encouraging fellow immigrants to find community in agriculture.
Nothing beats a farm. I'm just pursuing happiness.
Learn more at farmcredit.com/beginning.
Welcome back. In the early days of the Biden administration, Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack said addressing racial equity concerns was going to be a big priority at the department. Since then, the department has been seeking out stakeholder input and making internal equity assessments at different branches of USDA. We asked Deputy Secretary Bernard what the department has learned thus far.
In terms of racial justice and equity, we've been laser focused on work through multiple work streams of equity. We kind of have several pillars as we look at how we can make sure that we have a workplace that really addresses our efforts and our ongoing efforts on equity. Of course, you are probably very familiar with the Equity Commission that we receive funding to support through the American Rescue Plan. That's kind of our external look on, from outside stakeholders who are taking a comprehensive look at us in terms of all that we're doing to advance equity. But we had already begun to take a look at our equity efforts. And of course, this was spearheaded by the Biden-Harris administration. But we have equity action plans that we have developed, which are highlighted in terms of the services that we can offer to our customers in a fair and equitable way. And as part of that, we focused on technical assistance, being able to provide technical assistance through partners that are trusted by many of the underserved communities we serve. We have really tried to reduce barriers to ensure we have equitable access to programs like our USDA nutrition programs. We're looking at equity in federal procurement. We're also looking at upholding our federal trust and treaty responsibilities with Indian tribes and really committing to work towards civil rights, ensuring civil rights for everyone. So those are efforts that we're doing. And we have a DEIA strategic plan that has allowed us to focus on how we can really have a diverse workforce, a strong workforce that's going to make us strong in terms of diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility. So those are things that we're doing in addition to the work of the Equity Commission that is going to really hold our feet to the fire in how we deliver to audiences who have been discriminated against in the past.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of the Equity Commission, so they're set to, roll out their recommendations to USDA in late 2022. You know, is the commission still on track to meet that deadline?
Oh, we are 100% on track. We launched our first meeting virtually at the end of February. We have 15 very highly qualified members of the Equity Commission. We have, I'm the co-chair alongside Arturo Rodriguez, who is President Emeritus of the United Farm Workers. And we have an ag subcommittee that's comprised of 15 members, two of whom will be serving as liaisons to the Equity Commission. We've already met. We've had two meetings, one virtually, one face-to-face. And ahead of the next meeting, we will be launching our next subcommittee, the Rural Community Economic Development Subcommittee, and they will focus on persistent poverty issues in rural communities. During the first two meetings, we have talked a lot about some of the historical reports of related to racial discrimination in the past. There were over 700 recommendations that have come out of those previous reports, and so we are providing the status updates and where those recommendations are. The committee's also has begun to identify ideas for an interim report. They have come up with 40 ideas thus far that could potentially become recommendations. And we will know more at our next meeting about what that interim report will look like. So we are excited about the next meeting that we can continue to do our work, but we are 100% on task with all of our goals. And that's something that Secretary Vilsack and I do not want to get off of. We are 100% targeted on getting that final report due within a year from the launch of the Equity Commission, which is what we promised to do.
Mm-hmm. And just real quick here before we let you go, how do you think this is an area that USDA could set an example for the rest of the agriculture industry?
I think when we talk about looking at racial justice and equity from all vantage points, one, we're looking inwardly and outwardly. I think one of the things that we have done that I feel is the first step is how we have been very vocal in acknowledging our past history. And I think that's the first step towards changing your future. So we fully acknowledge the past discrimination, the impact that has had on multiple audiences, and we take responsibility for that. Now we are working to correct the wrongs, and that's just not only in terms of the folks that we serve. We're looking at how we can do that internally, even with the people that we are hiring and we have on staff. This is probably one of the most diverse leadership teams that we've had at USDA in terms of senior leadership levels. That shows the investment we've already made in leading change in this space at USDA. And there's no doubt under the leadership of Secretary Vilsack that we are going to be very successful here. So as we continue to launch our multiple streams of work and make these changes internally, we're already setting ourselves up for success. So I'm very optimistic that you will begin to see change that's going to pay forward years into the future.
Deputy Secretary Bernaugh, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be right back with our panel discussion, but first, Haley Bicklehop takes a deeper look at food inflation for the 4th of July weekend in this week's Ag by the Numbers.
Whether apple pie or homemade potato salad are your favorite 4th of July foods, Independence Day cookouts will cost more this year. The American Farm Bureau Federation reports the average holiday cookout will cost consumers 17% more than last year. A meal for 10 people will cost consumers $69.68, which is about $10 more than last year. This breaks down to about $7 per person. Ground beef has increased the most of any of our picnic staples, rising about 36%. Boneless, skinless chicken breasts cost 33% more, as do pork and beans. Only three items on the AFBF survey lowered in price. Strawberries now cost 16% less, sliced cheese decreased in price by 13%, and potato chips are 4% cheaper. Why such an increase in prices? Farm Bureau Chief Economist Roger Cryan says there is too much money in the economy, increasing demand and driving food prices higher. Other products that have increased in price include fresh squeezed lemonade, homemade potato salad, hamburger buns, vanilla ice cream, and chocolate chip cookies. For this week's Ag by the Numbers, I'm Haley Bicklehop.
Farmers are always there for each other. We shed tears together, we celebrate together, but we also grow together. Farm Bureau is the largest general farm organization in the country. We have the farmers' back. If you're a farmer and you're not a member, we would welcome you into our Farm Bureau family. And if you want to know more about agriculture, come be part of this great family.
Welcome back to AgriPulse Newsmakers. For this week's panel discussion, we are joined by Gary Madison with the Farm Credit Council, Jeremy Peters with the National Association of Conservation Districts, and Mark Stewart with Agriculture Future of America. Guys, thank you so much for joining us today. So Gary, to kick off the interview here, you know, as a member of USDA's Equity Commission, what would you say has been one of the biggest surprises that you have seen about where diversity and equity stand in American agriculture?
Well, you know, it's always hard to know what you don't know. And being on the Equity Commission now, having had some phone calls and a meeting in person, I'm just startled by the degree of equity experiences and life experiences that my fellow ag subcommittee members have. That was fairly surprising. Back to what I said, you just don't know what you don't know until you find out. But it's a group of people who are all fairly concerned about accomplishment and integrity in the discussions that we have. So I feel like we're going to be able to offer some recommendations to USDA that will be effective.
And can you kind of share what maybe some of those recommendations are thus far?
Well, that would get me in trouble. I'm sorry, I can't do that. I've been coached by USDA that prospective pronouncements are not appreciated. But I'd think that in a large part that thinking about the processes of USDA and in terms of customer service is my personal way of thinking about how to help USDA improve what they're doing. So that's the personal perspective I'm bringing to the subcommittee.
Mm-hmm. And Mark, you have a lot of students in your membership who are getting ready to join the agriculture workforce. You know, what kind of things are you hearing from them about the career environment that they are hoping and looking for as their next career?
Yeah, well, again, thanks for having me. I think we look at things from a generational standpoint, and college students today are affectionately known as Gen Zers, and they have a great deal of passion for, you know, a values-based workplace, and they can sniff out inauthentic people or workplaces. And so it's just going to be an interesting time for young people, and especially as industry is trying to adjust and attract top talent, and as competitive as it's ever been for talent, they have to figure out how to adjust and create equitable workplaces, allow young people to see themselves in their work culture, and it has to be authentic, more so than ever before. And so I think, you know, we sit between industry and young people, and so these are the conversations we hear, and we see all sorts of different initiatives. And but at the end of the day, the ones that are going to do it right are going to attract the most talent, and that's the opportunity for our industry today.
Mm-hmm. And kind of just looking at the broader agriculture workforce, Jeremy, bringing you in here, how would you describe the current state of, especially like the NRCS staffing levels out in the countryside? What are you hearing on the ground?
Yeah, we're definitely seeing, you know, an increase in terms of the number of positions that are being filled, which is a good thing. There's like with most all sectors, there's been the workforce challenges the last 2 years with a large number of retirements or people leaving positions for other opportunities. And conservation has certainly not been immune to that. But we are seeing an increase in hiring, especially in the local offices, where the customer experience is just so important. The demand continues to increase for conservation assistance. And so we want to make sure that we've got the highly skilled, highly trained workforce that is ready to respond to the challenges that they're seeing in their local communities.
We'll be right back with more from our panel right after this.
Looking closer, seeing further. That's how we do it. At Curious Plot, we're driven to find what's next for agriculture, animal care, and food. We stay curious because that's what it takes to grow understanding. That's how we plot strategies and tell stories that get results time after time. Marketing, communications, and consulting that look closer and see further. Curious Plot. We can't wait to help you tell your story.
Welcome back. Our panel discussion continues by taking a look at the current job placement rate for graduating students.
We pay attention to the report that USDA and Purdue puts out every year and show it. It's the most recent one is the 2020 to 2025 report, and it definitely shows a deficit when you look at students coming out of true food, agriculture, environment, natural resources type careers. So we only have about 60% of graduates to fill the open roles in an annual cycle for jobs. The other 40% roughly is filled with allied degrees. So students that aren't going through the traditional ag schools and have some sort of an allied degree program. So it's doable. You know, industry is getting more creative about where they attract students from. So they're not necessarily always relying on the colleges of agriculture at our land grant systems. And then you throw on a whole sort of other issues that we're going to face probably over the next decade. You know, fertility rates have been dropping. And so there's a lot of institutions that are really worried about enrollment and the decline in that enrollment. When you think about this conversation and diversity, equity, and inclusion, there have been dropping trends in males enrolled in colleges and post-high school degree programs. So that's concerning. You have COVID and its impacts. And so, you know, a drop in international enrollment for international students. So there's a lot of things going on. At the end of the day, yes, there is a deficit with students in true ag, natural resources, food related degree programs. And our opportunity as an industry is to figure out how to attract more students, especially minorities, underserved populations, and men into those programs.
And Gary, the Farm Credit Council has taken on its own effort to attract more diverse array of internships. What have you learned there that might benefit the rest of the agriculture industry?
Well, you know, I think what agriculture needs to picture to help address this recruitment problem is that we're not going to keep getting a supply of farm kids to work in our agricultural organizations for organizations like Farm Bureau. You have to look beyond who you would normally think of being a candidate for either a hire or for us, also for a beginning farmer customer. So that's led us to do some things that we've never done from the national level before, like job fairs, virtual job fairs, of course, for the last few years, and a launching leaders program that involves paying a stipend in addition to what our local farm credit associations around the country would pay their paid interns over summer. So we sort of bumped that up with some extra cash to fill in the holes of how do they get to that new job, how do they rent an apartment, that sort of thing. So we're really trying to look beyond not just what we do, but also who we are aiming those programs at, and cooperating with groups like, of course, AFA for a long time, but also Manners as another group that would get us to a more diverse audience.
Mm-hmm. And are you finding there to be a steady flow of applicants to those internships?
Yes. Yeah, you know, funny thing, you let somebody know that there's such a thing as farm credit out there, and gosh, it's a great way to learn about finance and get some skills and try out a job, essentially, is what our summer interns are really doing. People respond well to that. We've really had some stellar candidates from our outreach to the Native American community through the Native American Youth Summit every year. So, you know, you put some breadcrumbs out there and say, hey, we got a great deal, and all of a sudden they're folks that are just knocking on your door and wanting to get the experience that can be provided by an organization like Farm Credit.
Mm-hmm. And Jeremy, to kind of wrap up our discussion here, going back to the local staffing levels out at those NRCS levels, you know, how does NACD want the government to approach its local staffing needs? What resources is needed out there?
Yeah, very good question. And, you know, we're doing a lot at the national level, similar to Farm Credit and to AFA, you know, really looking at what are the future needs? Where are the areas that capacity is needed? We've been investing heavily the last 5 or 6 years in urban agriculture through technical assistance grants in partnership with NRCS to make sure that, you know, there's technical capacity in areas where urban agriculture is so popular. But also looking at the needs across all the country, you know, we want to make sure that as people are thinking about careers in conservation, that they've got the proper training, that they have the proper skill sets, that they also have the background knowledge for people that maybe this is their first experience with conservation on farm. You know, more and more kids are growing up without on-farm experiences. And they need to be able to understand, you know, when they're stepping onto a farm for the first time, that, you know, there are things that they need to be familiar with, whether that's practices that they need to know about, equipment that they need to know about, just the vernacular that's utilized in terms of farm management, all those soft skills that are so important to working with landowners to help them get to positive actions in adopting conservation practices. So really looking holistically at what the needs are and making sure that we're helping to equip the next generation of conservation professionals.
Mm-hmm. Well, Gary, Jeremy, and Mark, thank you so much for joining us today. We'll be right back with more AgriPulse Newsmakers, but first, Haley Bicklehop has a report on where exactly the nation's wind energy production is located in this week's Map It Out.
Wind-based energy production has made massive strides in the U.S. over the last two decades. In 2021, the nation produced 380 billion kilowatt hours of wind power, a 63-fold increase since 2000. Throughout the United States and U.S.-owned territories, there are more than 87,000 wind turbines. As seen on this map, the Midwest and Central region are two areas that have seen the most wind turbine growth. Iowa is a leader when it comes to in-state electrical power. The Department of Energy says in 2021, 57% of the state's electrical power came from wind energy. Notably, Kansas, Oklahoma, South Dakota, and North Dakota each had more than 30% of their energy provided by wind. In 2020, more wind energy was installed than any other energy source. These strides in renewable energy support the Biden administration's goal of creating a carbon pollution-free power sector by 2035. For this week's Map It Out, I'm Haley Bicklehopped.
Did you know AgriPulse has all your favorite podcasts, including Open Mic, Newsmakers, and Drive Time? Take us wherever you go. Subscribe at AgriPulse.com or on Spotify, Google Play, or Apple Podcasts.
Agriculture Future of America is a nonprofit building transformational leaders in food and agriculture. AFA prepares college students to join the workforce as innovative and engaged young professionals who will shape the future of agriculture. Head to agfuture.org to find out how you can get involved. Thanks again for tuning in for another episode of AgriPulse Newsmakers. Before we let you go, here's what's on the horizon for the week to come. Congress is on its second week of recess in observance of the Independence Day holiday. We'll also be watching the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations and the release of its food price index on Friday. As always, keep an eye on AgriPulse.com for the latest farm policy news in Washington and across the country. For AgriPulse Newsmakers, I'm Hannah Pagel, and from all of us at AgriPulse, have a happy 4th of July.
Newsmakers is a production of AgriPulse Communications. For more ag policy news, visit AgriPulse.com. You can also find our new content on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to follow AgriPulse and our correspondents on social media to get breaking news and more.